It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last Friday, we spoke with Republican Senator Alberta Darling about her proposed legislation to toughen drunken driving penalties.
Other preventative strategies were discussed at the OWI hearing earlier that week, but they received little attention in the three bills actually proposed.
Shemaine Mills has more on those alternatives.
Lawmakers are trying to find an answer to a question that's been dogging police, prosecutors, and families affected by drunk driving for years.
How do we really solve the problem of drunk driving if there's a way that we can prevent drunk drivers from getting into that vehicle?
That's Sun Prairie Democrat Gary Hebel. He notes 2 years ago, ignition locks were made mandatory for all repeat offenders and first-timers with a blood alcohol content of 0.15 or higher.
Even with interlocking devices, we still have the problem with them driving someone else's car.
And some drivers ordered by a judge to get ignition locks can't afford it, even with the hardship provision, says Nina Emerson. She directs the Resource Center on Impaired Driving at UW-Madison's Law School.
If they're not installed, it's not going to work. It's a simple fact.
Emerson supports ignition locks. As for pending legislation that toughens penalties, she says they won't have much of a deterrent effect on drunk drivers.
In order for any stricter laws to have any impact on people, people have to believe that they can be apprehended.
The author of tougher drunk driving legislation, Republican Jim Ott of Mequon, concedes laws alone are not the answer.
We're not going to solve the problem of drunk driving simply by passing tougher laws. I totally acknowledge that. But the idea is whatever we can do to decrease it and to significantly decrease it, which I think these bills would do.
Nina Emerson says one change that could help is unpopular among lawmakers. She says the state could allow sobriety checkpoints.
That doesn't mean we mandate them. That doesn't mean you make law enforcement do it. It means that for the law enforcement agencies that want to conduct them, they can do that.
But opposition has come from libertarians and the Tavern League of Wisconsin. The group's Pete Madlin says roving patrols are more effective than roadblocks.
We are against drunk driving. And we know that a more effective way to catch drunk drivers is the use of roping patrols and not sobriety checkpoints.
The National Office of Mothers Against Drunk Driving supports sobriety checkpoints. It says they may result in fewer arrests than roving patrols, but that's because of their deterrent effect. At the legislative hearing on penalties, Milwaukee County Assistant DA Ron Dagg says checkpoints may make a dent in what he calls a cultural issue in Wisconsin.
The Friday night activity is let's go drinking. But if they look at the 5 o'clock news and see, wow, they're doing sobriety checkpoints, and if we drive, we could get pulled over, even if we're driving okay, that has been shown to be a huge deterrent effect.
The federal government and car makers have been researching how to prevent alcohol-impaired driving deaths. UW-Madison engineering professor John Lee says touch technology that senses alcohol through the skin is rapidly moving toward implementation. He says some car makers, like Volvo, already measure steering and acceleration and give a dashboard warning if vehicle movement is erratic because of alcohol, fatigue, or distraction.
There's a fairly common phenomena, sort of a Lake Wobegon effect, where people believe that they're better than average drivers. I think the vast majority of people believe that they're better than average drivers, and that's not true.
Lee says feedback from a driver's vehicle may make drivers realize that. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks for that report, Shemaine.
We'll be taking your calls during this segment. What do you think about harsher punishments for drunk drivers? Or what do you think about alternatives like sobriety checkpoints, breathalyzer technologies in cars, or OWI rehab?
You heard Nina Emerson in Shemaine's piece there. She joins us now in the studio. She's the director of the Resource Center on Impaired Driving at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Nina, thanks for coming up here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we heard some about the proposed legislation there. What do you make of that? Do you think it's a step in the right direction?
Well, of course, the legislators who are proposing it would say that, yes, we are creating a deterrent effect by making penalties tougher. But as I mentioned in the earlier piece, people have to believe that they could be apprehended for penalties to have that deterrent value. And the other thing that's troubling is that Wisconsin has a penalty scheme for 10th and subsequent OWI offenders. as well as 7th, 8th, and 9th, as well as 5th and 6th. And it's the only state that has penalties that go up to that high of a level of offenses, which should indicate that there's a problem there, in my mind.
Well, that seems like a big part of the problem, those repeat offenders. And it's, I mean, flip open newspapers, go online here in Wisconsin. Daily, it seems like you're seeing those numbers, 5th, 8th, whatever offense. What would be effective to treat that kind of repeat drunk driving offender?
Well, and it is true that those are the offenders who make the headlines. But in reality, it's actually a smaller proportion of the overall offender population. Mm-hmm. But by the time somebody reaches 5th or 6th offense, it's probably safe to say that the person has a substance abuse problem. And so for the time that that person is in jail or in prison, the people on the roadways are safer, but punishment and jail alone do not make a person sober. And if the person needs treatment in order to quit drinking and driving, that's what they really need. And there's nothing in these bills that provides for that treatment.
In your dream vision of how we would treat drunk driving overall, would there be that addiction treatment component?
Definitely.
And then sobriety checkpoints you talked about in that story. And you just mentioned, I don't care maybe if I'm the drunk driver. I don't care how long the prison sentence is going to be, how big the fine is going to be. I'm not going to get caught.
Exactly.
So I don't care. So it's not always popular. You make the case for sobriety checkpoints. Why do you think those would be so effective?
Because they create that risk of apprehension, because there's this police presence and you don't know if perhaps in the route that you're going to take home, if you might be stopped. In Wisconsin now, an officer has to have reasonable suspicion to stop a vehicle, whether it's an equipment violation or a traffic violation. So that means that a driver has to either screw up behind the wheel or has to have something wrong with his or her car before that person is stopped. So the sobriety checkpoints really makes the police presence more apparent to people and hence the risk of apprehension.
But you see why people could be uncomfortable with that, even if somebody is opposed to drunk driving, wants to crack down on it. Just the feeling of having checkpoints that stop everyone, you know, without cause, that sets a lot of people on edge.
And I do understand that argument. But if you are driving within the boundaries of the law, then you have nothing to fear. I mean, you don't have anything. The law doesn't say absolute sobriety. It says that you shouldn't be impaired or above a 0.08 alcohol concentration. So the surveys that have been done in the states that conduct them, the people who have been stopped say it's a minimal intrusion. It's a very brief stop, because if there's nothing to proceed with, then you're flagged on through.
Well, we've talked a little bit about laws. Let's turn to technology now. And Shemaine talked about that a little in the story. Right now we have, in some cases, ignition interlocks. What does it take for somebody to have a court say, hey, you got to have one of these things?
Well, in July of 2010, when a comprehensive OWI package went into law, that requires judges to order ignition interlock devices on all OWI offenders. On first offense, your alcohol concentration has to be above a 0.15, but also for all people who refuse to take the chemical test, the you know, like the intoximeter or submit to the blood test. And so that it's either going to be ordered as a condition of your driving privilege or ordered on the vehicle that you own. And judges have been ordering them. The problem is there's a real disconnect in people actually having them installed on their vehicles.
So I get the court order, but I put off getting the thing put in there.
Right.
Or I drive somebody else's car.
Right.
And then we heard about this new technology coming. It's down the pipe. It's not going to solve anything soon. Do you see a day when most all cars have some sort of warning system or even a prevention system for drunk driving?
I think it's possible. I mean, given the role that technology is playing in our lives and it increases on a daily basis, that doesn't surprise me in the least bit. And I think that it would really be rather effective because then people aren't left to guess, well, I wonder if I'm above a 0.05 or I wonder if I shouldn't drive because the car won't let you drive.
Talking to Nina Emerson, director of the Resource Center on Impaired Driving at the UW Law School. Interested to hear what you think.
And what do you think needs to change about these laws? Do we need tougher penalties? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.
Continuing our conversation now with Nina Emerson, director of the Resource Center on Impaired Driving at the UW Law School. We'll get to your phone calls about drunk driving in just a couple minutes at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to change? Is it laws? Do we need technology? Or do we need to change the way we think and act? Is this a cultural issue? And Nina, let's pick up with that idea. I mean, a lot of people like to go out and drink with other people. They're in another place and they need to get back home. And so far, it seems like they're willing to do it even if they've been drinking a fair amount. What does it take to shift that culture?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, I think. And there actually has been a shift and an improvement since the 1980s in terms of fewer people driving drunk. There has been a marked decline in alcohol-related crashes and fatalities. So we are actually making progress. Sometimes it doesn't necessarily feel that way. But I think that people need to probably the best advice is to plan ahead. If you know that you're going to be going out partying, the time to make that decision about how to get home is not at midnight or not at bar time, because at that time, you're not in the position to make a sound decision about whether you should drive or not. It's also very challenging in more rural areas where there are not cabs available. But the Tavern League of Wisconsin does have a safe ride program that is available to, and it's offered by their participating tavern members. And if somebody is too drunk to drive home, then a ride will be provided to that person.
I wanted to ask you about that. Is that a solution? I know in Madison we have some safe ride. I was just up in Minocqua a few weeks back out at the bars late at night, and there were safe ride cars parked out there on the main drag by the bars.
Right.
Do those make a difference?
Definitely. They definitely do. And perhaps there just aren't enough of them. The other thing is that a lot of times people just don't think that they're drunk. And some people don't want to leave their cars at the place where they've been drinking. So there are a number of factors that play into whether or not somebody is willing to take an alternative ride home.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Mark with us calling from Stanley. Mark, hi, you're on the air. Mark, are you there?
Yes, I am. My son died in a drunk driving accident a couple years ago. He rolled his pickup truck, and I just wanted to say that a funeral costs $10,000, and, you know, that doesn't count the emotional cost, and it'd be a lot cheaper than to have the alcohol interlock than a funeral. Thank you.
Gotcha. Mark, thanks, and sorry for your loss. Nina?
Yes, that is and there are a number of tragedies like that, which is very, very sad, and that's what leads people to want these tougher penalties. But a person who is partying or drinking with friends and then drives home, and that the intent of that person is not to kill somebody, but that's what happens sometimes because people are in fact impaired. So the tougher penalties, especially for homicide by intoxicated use, there isn't always a real direct connection, because the people who end up committing that offense, that they never intended to do it. So the deterrent value is if you think that you're going to do that, and then you know that the prison is going to be, you know, a mandatory minimum of 10 years. Wow, I better not drive home drunk because I might kill somebody. But people don't think that way. And that's the problem.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to James in Madison. James, hi.
Hello. I'm actually a former OWI prosecutor. I just have a few points for Ms. Emerson. I think the first one is Wisconsin's laws are actually pretty tough already when compared to states like Colorado, where there are no felonies. They're all misdemeanors. One of the things about Wisconsin that it does is it counts lifetime offenses for OWIs, whereas other states only count maybe 5 years or 10 years. And because of that, it's always more sensational when you hear about a 10th offense because in other states it's not counted as a 10th offense. My second point is that as far as the what we can do to stop OWIs, there's the ignition interlock devices, but a lot of times courts aren't enforcing those. What has to happen is a lot more of the vehicle seizures and actually making an economic price for people who continue to drive drunk, because a lot of times, even if they're penalized with operating after revocations, they're gotcha. Actually just continuing to drive. And then my last point, and I'll be brief, is I'll just leave it right there.
Gotcha. Thanks, James. And you brought up plenty to talk about. Let's go last point first. Impound vehicles, takeaway vehicles for at some point in the prosecution.
Well, I appreciate his comments since he was a former prosecutor, as he pointed out. But in terms of the vehicle seizure and impoundment, with Wisconsin Act 100, we eliminated vehicle seizure, forfeiture, and impoundment of vehicles. That had been in effect since 1993, and it did not work. And that's why we eliminated it, and that's why the legislature put the emphasis on ignition interlock devices. And prosecutors actually hated the vehicle seizure and forfeiture. And the biggest problem with either of those laws, you seize an offender's vehicle, but there is nothing in the law that prevents that person from going out and purchasing another vehicle. And that's what people would do. So it didn't prove to be as effective as we had hoped it would be initially. And again, that's why we go to ignition interlock devices. I think it's interesting that James brought up Colorado, because that's where I'm from. And I actually had a conversation with an attorney in Colorado about the OWI laws there. And I was telling him that we have 7th, 8th, 9th offenders here. And he said, you would never get there in Colorado. And yes, part of it is, James, because of the counting period. Most states don't go back as far as Wisconsin does. But the other part is that it's actually, even though they're misdemeanors, it's treated much more seriously. And people go to prison and they go to jail. And so you don't end up with a 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th offender. So I don't, you know, it's comparing apples and oranges, and you're right. The penalties are tough in Wisconsin already, but there's still a lot of room for improvement.
All right, thanks for the call, James. Time for one more. Dennis is with us in Conover. Dennis, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I have. My main point is now the courts. I'm a third offense drunken driver, and the courts come up with this outfit where they call it a driver safety plan. And that is your rehabilitation. You're supposed to go to these places that won't accept insurance. Probably all the people in there don't have any degrees as far as rehabilitation or psychological. And it's just ridiculous. I think the Department of Correction and the state of Wisconsin needs to stay out of people's business as far as the health goes.
Gotcha. Thanks, Dennis, for the call. And so he's been sent into rehab. He doesn't think it's effective and doesn't work.
Well, he was referring to what's called the driver safety plan, and that's a program that offenders are to complete in order to be eligible to reinstate their driver license. It's not meant to be treatment, and so I'm sorry if he viewed it as being treatment, because it's designed to help drivers so that they can satisfy that requirement and then legally reinstate their driver license.
Nina, in our last minute, how much is this a Wisconsin thing? I mean, we hear that Wisconsin's particularly bad nationwide. Are we just part of a national problem, or is there something specially bad?
Wisconsin's very special in this area, I think. I mean, Wisconsin does a lot of things right with their impaired driving laws, but there definitely is a lot of room for improvement in terms of the acceptance of alcohol use and the prevalence of alcohol. And because of those things, then it's really hard to separate alcohol consumption from the act of driving.
You've been at this a long time. Do you feel positive? Do you feel optimistic when you keep working on this year after year?
Well, it's easy to get discouraged, but I think a lot of the changes are incremental, and I think with the help of technology, we'll see more improvements.
Nina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Nina Emerson, director of the Resource Center on Impaired Driving at the University of Wisconsin Law School.
The news is next, and then we'll hear about how today's domestic surveillance and anti-terror efforts compared to fears of anarchist bombings a century ago. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We're trying something new today, taking a current event or issue in the news and then digging into American history to see how it all fits in.
And Jonathan Pollack is here in the studio to help us do that. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me in, Rob. It's great to be here.
Before we get into our topic today, which is surveillance, anti-terrorism, that sort of thing, I wanted to talk about what we're doing. And this was actually your idea. What are we trying to accomplish here, man?
Well, what we're trying to do is take a minute to examine some of the deep context for big issues of the day. That so often in broadcasting and especially in radio, we just kind of zip from one thing to another. We look for the day's changes over a story that's unfolding over a period of time. And we never get a chance to go back and look at the really deep context. So knowing that public radio tends to dig into these stories in more detail than commercial radio, and knowing that you had a new show where you kind of said, yeah, we've got all this time and we're not sure what to do, I couldn't help but pitch this idea I've thought about for a long time. So thanks a lot for having me on.
Yeah. And, you know, I catch myself sometimes using the word unprecedented when I'm talking about something in the United States. And then when I go back and read history, I think, oh, wait, precedent. It's all happened before in some permutation.
It's one of the things I really enjoy about teaching history is that often people always say the same kind of things, that we've never seen this before, that there's nothing like it. And I think some of the fun of history is trying to find precedent. Historians don't agree on it. I mean, the stuff we're going to talk about today, there could be people listening who say, well, no, that's not really a valid precedent because of this and so. But that's what keeps the discipline interesting. That's why people keep writing history of things that happened 50 or 100 or 200 years ago, because we can always look at what's a precedent in a new and exciting way.
Well, here's what's going on today. We've got revelations about how the NSA is doing surveillance on phone calls, on our internet communications, fears of terrorist attacks, real fears, obviously. What stands out to you as a precedent in American history, maybe going back to the beginning?
Okay, so the furthest back precedent I can find goes back to the very early days of the Republic. In 1798, the U.S. was involved in what historians have called the quasi-war with France. And that is after the French Revolution of 1789, which France saw as being kind of in the spirit of the American Revolution, the U.S. kind of backed off on supporting the French Revolution as it turned into the terror, as France kind of imploded on itself. Americans kind of held back on their aid to France. So when Napoleon Bonaparte came into power and began expanding the French Empire through Europe, and he was asking for American assistance in this, and the U.S. really backed off, Napoleon began to imply that perhaps France would attack the United States next. Given that the French territory of Saint-Domingue, which became Haiti, was embroiled in revolution during the same time. It was a revolution of slaves against slave owners, and the American economy was dependent on slaves for much of its agricultural production. the U.S. was really scared of France. And so France, using the language you talked about before, Rob, France in some ways was seen as possibly funding subversive activities within the United States, designed to destabilize it in this time of, again, it wasn't a declared war. France didn't declare war on the United States, nor vice versa, but it was a half war. It was a quasi-war going on.
So what was the reaction from President Adams? I'll test myself in the history.
Ding! All right. Very nice. Excellent. Yes. So John Adams passed a series of acts that were designed to guard against this possibility of French subversion in the United States. They come to be called the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798. In brief, the Alien Acts clamped down on immigration to the United States, making it much harder for people to become citizens, to have the right to vote, and so forth. The Sedition Acts clamped down on freedom of the press. That criticism of the president, which in the late 18th century, by the way, is hilarious. It's really worth checking out some late 18th century newspapers because they're very broad kind of parodies of the president and politicians generally. All of a sudden, that's verboten. That's something you can't do. So that was Adams's response. Adams was a Federalist, and the rival party, the Democratic Republicans, kind of led by Thomas Jefferson, responded by calling for nullification. Jefferson was the author of, but under a pseudonym, of a series of documents called the Kentucky Resolutions that advocated that states rise up and kind of not pay attention to this. What I think is sort of optimistic, and we can sort of see, you know, we can see some of the parallels here, that there's a war that might not really be a war, and there's fear of people coming to the United States with the aim of subverting it. What came out of this shortly after Jefferson became president in 1801 was that, number one, the acts were repealed, and number two, it really made the issue of civil liberties and freedom of speech super important, that they were repealed, and there was a huge backlash to them, really, in much of the West, in the South, in many parts of the country. It was Adams certainly had his logic for doing that, and given the uncertainty associated with France, we can see where they'd come to that. But this huge backlash resulted in a real attention paid to freedoms of speech, even speech that criticized the president in really broad ways.
And it starts off this argument we still have today. Where do you draw the line between security needs and the Bill of Rights?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That the that battle was that line was drawn, and that question remained out there. I'd argue that that the Bill of Rights, that the freedom of speech really had the upper hand really up through the Civil War. And then during the Civil War, of course, Abraham Lincoln clamped down on habeas corpus, really struck down a great deal of the Democratic press in the United States, even in Madison. I've looked at the Madison Democrat, the Democratic Party newspaper in Madison in the early 1860s. Oh, and they can't stand Lincoln, and they publish editorials against him, and then they stop publishing.
Shut down.
Right. They got shut down along with a bunch of other papers critical of Lincoln during the Civil War. And again, it becomes this really tricky constitutional question that the idea, do we say, well, the Civil War was a terrible idea and it shouldn't have happened because of the threat made to freedom of speech along the way? Or do we say that the freedom of speech was a necessary casualty, or was the cause just, but Lincoln overstepped his bounds? In Wisconsin, it seems a lot more abstract, but in parts of the country that were more on the border, in southern Ohio, in southern Pennsylvania, out in Missouri, and so forth, those were really border states in a whole lot of ways, not just geographically, but also there was a real sense that they might desert the Union and join the Confederacy.
And that's one where you said at the outset, not everybody's going to agree on how we look back on this. And that's one that's still a live argument, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, that still comes up quite a bit. And I think especially during this period we're in right now, that, you know, we're looking at the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. And so as much as the Civil War is always a popular part of how we do history in the United States, now it's especially so. Even people who aren't reenactors, even people who aren't self-described Civil War buffs, programming in public libraries and local historical societies really focuses on the Civil War to a great extent. Friends of mine who are Civil War specialists are just like not taking calls anymore because everybody wants them to come out and say something about the Civil War, about a phase of the Civil War.
Well, when we promoted this segment, we mentioned anarchist attacks and the fear of those attacks about a century ago. And you mentioned before the show that has a lot to do with the arguments we have today.
Yeah. So the Espionage Act of 1917 came about during World War I, where where also one of the spurs for the U.S. to get into World War I was fear of German subversives in the United States, and particularly in Wisconsin. Of course, Fighting Bob La Follette, who's revered as a hero by all in Wisconsin, was called an unhung traitor by former President Theodore Roosevelt. One of my favorite lines about La Follette. It's fascinating when I moved here, because really in every other part of the country, people think of La Follette as this oddball, and hear people of all stripes rally behind him, and you know he's a big hero. So the Espionage Act was designed to clamp down on initially pro-German activity, but as the Russian Revolution followed on the heels of the Espionage Act, and as the Soviets that came to power talked about a global communist revolution, and communists in the United States echoed this idea, the Espionage Act very quickly pivoted and became a way to clamp down on communist speech, on socialist speech, during the end of the war and even the immediate post-war period. Of course, as you mentioned, Rob, it was used often against anarchists, and the American press was hopelessly confused about the differences between anarchism and communism. They were all radicals kind of lumped together, and that speech was proscribed.
And so what ended up happening? There was a big crackdown following the Espionage Act.
Well, yes, there was a huge crackdown. A couple thousand people were arrested. But again, as in the case of the Alien and Sedition Act, the aftermath brought a huge attention to American civil liberties. What I think is also interesting about the issue of espionage is that the Espionage Act and the threat to free speech is that it crossed political boundaries in really interesting ways. That in looking to discredit Woodrow Wilson, for example, William Randolph Hearst, who was certainly no radical, championed the cause of Eugene Debs, the American socialist who had been jailed for the Espionage Act. Hearst ran this five-part series in Debs and his newspapers talking about what a super guy he was, and he was just this impassioned orator who got on the wrong side of a dumb act anyways, and was arguably instrumental in getting Debs freed from prison shortly before he died. So the reaction to the Espionage Act, as with the reaction to the Alien and Sedition Acts, caused this kind of transpartisan support for civil liberties and the freedom of speech.
And you can see that echoed today with people in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, on the same side in some cases with NSA surveillance, bringing
Absolutely.
It back home.
Yeah, looking at both sides of it, the people supporting or at least neutral on the idea of increased surveillance and the people opposed to it, it really crosses traditional party lines. And it's especially remarkable in this era where, as much as we talked about unprecedentedness earlier on, where I arguably have a kind of an unprecedented degree of party unity, that even so, this issue of free speech transcends party lines, even in these polarized times, and you find really unusual coalitions coming together.
John, the time flew by. Thanks a lot for coming up here.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
That was Jonathan Pollack, history instructor at Madison College.
Coming up, we'll talk to two Iraq War veterans who are embarking on an epic hike from Milwaukee to Los Angeles. It's part of an effort to help veterans make the transition to civilian life. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
Now that more and more of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are coming home, we're reminded of how challenging it can be for them to do so.
Post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, can dramatically affect the lives of veterans, lead to issues of addiction, depression, even suicide.
Two Milwaukee veterans are trying to raise awareness of these issues in a 2,700-mile walk from Milwaukee to Los Angeles. Joining us now are Tom Voss and Anthony Anderson. Both are Iraq War veterans, and the two are behind a project called Veterans Trek. Tom Voss, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Anthony Anderson, thanks as well to you for being here.
No problem.
Tom, this idea of walking from Milwaukee to Los Angeles was yours. Can you tell us how you came about that idea?
What it really stems from is I was at a point in my life where I needed to take some time to kind of go through the things I've been through with my deployment. So I actually ended up giving Anthony a call and asking if he had a rucksack that that I could use for the trip, and this kind of spurred Veterans Trek.
Hmm. And Anthony, you agreed to actually join Tom on this trek to show your support. Why is it important for you to do so?
Well, kind of like Tom, I didn't ever really take the time to or have the time just to kind of figure out what did I just do with my life? What have I been doing for the last you know, 5 years of my life with two deployments. And so when he called me and asked if he could borrow a ruck, like I was saying, the first thought in my head was, this dude is crazy. And then almost as quickly as that thought left my mind, it was, okay, how about I come with you? How about we do this together, support one another, and just try to make this something that we can both use for moving ahead with our lives.
Mm. Can I ask, how did you two become friends?
Tom and I met at Dry Hooch in Milwaukee. I was applying for a job. Tom worked there, and he was the person that did my interview. And over the course of the interview, all of a sudden it's like, oh, we have the same MOS. Oh, we were, which was our job in the military. We were both in the infantry. Oh, we were both there at the same time. And the interview became more of a conversation. And then from there and working together, we just became good friends.
And in fact, your trek benefits Dry Hooch. Can one of you explain what that is? Tell us a little
sure.
bit about it.
Yeah, Dry Hooch is a 501c3 nonprofit based out of Milwaukee, and what they really focus on is providing a safe social space for veterans and their families. So they kind of remove the bar and the alcohol from the conversation, hence Dry, and Hooch is also a place that you live in, you know, a hut or a tent. So it's a safe social space where veterans and the community can gather and help each other through difficult times. Yeah. And everything that they do at Dry Hooch is vet-to-vet, peer-to-peer. So they have like veteran-led support groups, or veterans can come in and have one-on-one mentoring. So it's really a great place for vets to come in, kind of re-experience some of the camaraderie that maybe they miss from not being in the military anymore, but also find other vets that understand what it means to be a veteran, and know that they're not being judged for the things that they have to say.
Mm. Well, before we start talking about the walk itself, Tom, you wanted to start this walk as a way to sort through some of the issues that you've experienced since coming home. Could you talk about those a little bit?
Well, I was deployed to Mosul, Iraq from 2004 to 2005. It was a pretty rough time. I had my platoon sergeant and squad leader both killed in action while I was there. I was 20 years old. And as soon as I got out in 2006, I basically, you know, tried to go to school, tried to, you know, try to fit that mold of what people expected me to be, which was just to pick up, you know, after you get out of the military, you know, get a job, go to school. And it really kind of backfired on me because I never really took the time to, you know, deal with what I was going through.
Mm. And Anthony, do you relate to some of the issues that Tom struggled with as well? What did you have to go through as you made your way back into civilian life?
Sure. After about the first month of being home, when all the welcome home parties were kind of over, and after I'd seen all my friends and my family and real life started to kind of kick back in, trying to go back to school, trying to get a job. I was married, so trying to reconnect with my wife. One of the issues that I had right away was I couldn't sleep at night. And when I couldn't sleep, really the only thing that would put me to sleep was if I just kind of drank myself to sleep. Mm-hmm. And so after a few months of doing that, I realized if I don't change something, I'm going to become dependent on alcohol. So I started to reach out, go to the VA, start talking to people. But really the issues that I had was I couldn't sleep. My interpersonal skills, my ability to just articulate a thought to anyone about how I was feeling, I really couldn't do it. So over the course of time, it's changed for me a bit, but I still struggle trying to feel emotion. Really, the good emotions that you feel when you're back here, they don't really play a part when you're in a combat zone, so you turn them off, and you really only utilize the things that make you aggressive or quick to do your job when you're in a combat zone. It's been a struggle for me to access any of the emotions outside of, say, like anger. Mm. So I really want to be able to go on this walk and try to work through some of that stuff. And when I'm done, hopefully I know I won't be who I was 10 years ago, but hopefully have some some semblance of where I want to be for the future.
Tom, what does that mean for you as you listen to Anthony and some of his needs? How does that affect the way you support each other while you're on the road?
Well, I mean, I think that's why we're really doing this together. And it's we've seen from working at Dry Hooch that, you know, one of the most effective ways of dealing with these issues is peer support. And I think it's going to be really important that we're both there to support each other when we need it, because I'm sure I'm going to have bad days at, you know, mile 2000 and I don't want to do it anymore, but, you know, I'll have Anthony there for that support.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us a little bit about the walk. When do you leave?
So we leave August 30th, so 3 weeks from tomorrow. We leave at 10 o'clock in the morning from the Milwaukee County War Memorial. That morning from 8:30 in the morning until 10, when we go, we'll be down there. We hope that other vets and supporters of our project will come down and show their support. And then from that day until, according to the math, till the end of January, we'll be walking every day. Our goal is 20 miles a day, but we're also realistic and we'll be listening to our bodies, so if we're feeling good and we can keep going a little farther, we will. But if it's a day where it's like, I've just had enough and it's only been 15 miles, you know, we'll kind of scale it back for that day.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how you're preparing for that in terms of the equipment you're bringing. You're going to be walking through some different climates, I'm sure, and obviously over the course of a couple of seasons.
Right, right. We've been actually really lucky and had a lot of the equipment donated through our social media. We're on Facebook and Twitter, and we have our website at veteranstrek.com. And we put our needs list up there, and we got a lot of community support, and they basically helped outfit us with the stuff that we need to make the trek through the seasons. Yeah, and there's still some stuff that we need that's posted on the website. One thing that we still need, we still definitely need a few pairs of shoes. And there's some other equipment that if people go to the website, they can see. But like Tom said, we've been very fortunate to have a number of veterans and veteran organizations and people that understand the need to support a mission for like this, because they understand what we're trying to do, reach out to us and not only donate monetarily, but also with the equipment that we need. So if we had to leave today, we could do it, but there's still some stuff that would make the trip a lot safer for us.
Mm-hmm. You've been deployed overseas, which is probably one of the hardest things a person can go through. But compared to that, how big of a challenge is this trek for you?
I think it's going to be a pretty big challenge, and I think that's one of the reasons why we decided to walk. I mean, you can, if we're not going to have a trail vehicle or support vehicle with us, and we're trying to make it challenging for us, and it's going to be challenging to try to work through some of the stuff. So, and I think, too, that even though Tom and I have been walking, I mean, this whole project has come together within the last 3 months. Tom and I get together on the weekends, and we walk together, adding weight to our rucks just to condition ourselves, but a lot of walking on our own time, getting ready physically. It is different than when you're deployed, but I think the physical challenge will be the hardest part.
Yeah.
The mental, I think both Tom and I are definitely prepared for and have had enough training and gone through enough in our own personal lives to see that we definitely have the ability to do it.
Okay, well, thank you so much for telling us about your journey, and we'll link to your website on our Facebook page. It was Tom Voss and Anthony Anderson, the duo behind Veterans Trek. I'm Cynthia Schuster with Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.